likes to hear it, but it is the truth. We are not living in the final phase of the pandemic, but still at the beginning. We will have to live with the virus for a long time.
It's Friday, April the 24th, 2020, and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration. I'm Darshan Vigneshwaran, and we're running a special series on the politics of the COVID crisis with my colleague, Abby Steele. And over the last week or so, since we last recorded, I've been facing, a bunch of moral conundrums that I think this crisis has opened up. Like, just so many things are happening so fast that there are all these crucial questions that I have no answer to. For example, like when I see all of these photos of protesters in the United States against the lockdown who have subsequently become ill or have even died from coronavirus, we have this sort of celebratory sort of message coming from the liberal left who are trying to support this, and what do you do with that sort of information, right? And how do we address that? And also in South Africa at the moment, there's one of the most harsh lockdowns that we're seeing. And at the same time, and lots of violence utilized to enforce the lockdown, lots of laws that we wouldn't ordinarily support, like a ban on alcohol, which are simultaneously having actually a really good effect on both the spread of the virus, seemingly, and also in terms of the ban on alcohol, on domestic violence, which is a huge problem in South Africa. At the moment in the Netherlands, I have a personal conundrum going on where I have two children who have both, I think, had the virus. They haven't been tested. And now the schools are just about to open up. And as the Netherlands appears to be sort of clearing parts of the virus, but and I don't really know whether I feel safe in sending them to school or whether I want to participate in this process. All I know is that I can't homeschool for another 2 weeks because it's gonna drive me crazy. Abby, I don't know, like, how are you feeling in response to all of these dilemmas that we're facing?
Yeah, it is really strange. I think it's really hard for most people to also take into account all of the possible externalities of our decisions personally, but also on a policy level, right? So I also feel nervous about schools opening. I also have children the same age as you, Darshan, where I'm also done homeschooling. and I think, I personally would benefit from having my children at school more often. But I also wonder if, other kids who don't have the same kind of support network at home or access to the internet, we know that these school closures are having a really uneven impact across different already sort of disadvantaged social groups. So for those kids, opening the schools up may be really important, and given the risks, maybe it's worth taking that risk. For these other things that we care about, right? About equality, about having a kind of social support for kids, in a way, of course, for those kids who are trapped in an abusive household, so that they can get out of it sometimes, at least for some parts of the day. Like, there are all these, it's so hard to put all of these things into balance and then say, this is definitively the best course of action, right?
Yeah, like, part of me wants to get the advice of like a political theorist or a moral ethicist, and part of me thinks that the moment that I do that, they're going to go, yeah, that's a really tough dilemma, and that's about all the guidance that I'm going to get. That there are just these questions that we're just not going to solve. Or be able to have the moral compass to navigate.
But I think also it's healthy to have a full discussion of these trade-offs in an open society. And so far, I haven't been completely impressed by political leaders who are not, to me, like, communicating all of these moving parts in a way that is, effective and persuasive. And then concluding also, this is really hard, right?
Yeah.
And I think I think some of the best leaders who've been doing this are, you know, the Angela Merkel, I think, has been doing a really good job from what I understand. And, you know, like not treating the public like they are not scientific enough to understand these important government decisions, right? Like that kind of communication is just so heavy-handed and unnecessary when there's so much uncertainty. I mean,
I thought like one of the things we'll move into introducing our guest, but one of the things that it, like in Rutte's recent sort of press conference, at least he gave us that bone of going, look, you know, I kind of know this sucks, right? Like, I know that guys want to have your festivals, you want to have, you know, a normal life and that sort of stuff. That there was a tiny bit of empathy in there, which I thought was good. But you want to talk about mascots, so let's get there.
Well, our guest today is Kyohei Yamada from Japan, who's a political scientist at the International University of Japan in Niigata Prefecture, which is just north of Tokyo. And Kyohei and I went to graduate school together. That's how we know Kyohei and tapped him for this guest appearance. And, you know, we've been hearing a lot about Japan, I think, in the news in the West, in the sense that it seems very puzzling to people in the West why death rates are relatively low in Japan while so much has remained open. And I mean, the first conversation was around the cruise ship that was docked, and then it seemed like this impending doom was about to hit Japan, and then nothing happened. We wanted to invite Kyohei to reflect on that, and then I wanted to say also that one of the more recent things I've read about Japan is that there have been mascots created, and one thing we know about Japan is the really enthusiastic embrace of mascots for all sorts of political organizations, local governments, and now we have a quarantine mascot.
Mascot.
So yeah. Kyohei, can you tell us what is the mascot of Niigata? Can you tell us?
So thank you, Abby and Darshan. Thank you. Thank you for having me today. So mascot in Japan is, maybe from the European perspective, crazy. So, I mean, even within Niigata, Prefecture probably have its own mascot. So Japan has like two layers of local government. The first layer is called prefectures, and there are 47 of them. The next layer is municipality, so approximately 1,700 across the country. And I mean, Niigata Prefecture has its own mascot, and each municipality probably have their own mascots, and even like police station, like some police stations. So police is under the control of prefecture, but prefecture police have some mascot, and sometimes separate different police stations also have their mascot. So yeah, I think it's quite, Census Bureau, like Statistics Bureau has its own mascot. And when I visit there, I got a file and pens with their mascots on, so
pens with the mascot.
It's quite popular, quite big.
So have people been embracing the quarantine mascot? I understand that the quarantine mascot was introduced last year already, like in bizarre anticipation of the pandemic.
I didn't know about it.
So Quarin? Oh yeah, gosh.
Yeah.
Okay, well maybe it's just like one guy in an apartment, you know, fabricating. Oh, yeah, mascot.
The thing is, there are so many mascots around Japan, so it's just impossible to keep track of that. So until recently I didn't know about those mascots, and there's just so many of them.
Okay, so the mascot is not going to help Japan avoid the fallout from the pandemic. Is that the conclusion to draw?
It's an interesting question. I mean, even those like a highway police in Niigata Prefecture has its own mascot, and the other day they were like distributing brochures. So I mean, I got really nervous when I saw a group of police officers on the highway, and what they are doing was just like actually with mascot, they're distributing some leaflet. So yeah, so I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether it's going to be effective or not, but that's like a very, I'd say one unique approach, a very unique approach, I think.
But from what I gather is that like the mascot is sort of, you know, symbolic in a couple of ways, in that like also the Japanese approach has been, the approach in Japan has been pretty hands off and not enforcing strict laws, not with a lot of heavy policing.
Right. So I guess it's being, I guess to some extent relaxing, I think. You might have heard that the Prime Minister declared emergency status. When was it? I think that was in the first week of April. But this emergency status is not as strict as in some other countries. So what happened was that Prime Minister decide which areas, which prefectures should be considered as emergency situation. Then governors of those prefectures can do certain things. Okay. Like for example, requesting residents to cooperate. So such as not going out beyond minimum necessity, or instructing facilities where many people gather to suspend their operation and so forth. But there's no penalty for non-compliance, for example, for going out.
And is there something like to the language of request that is different in Japan? Like if you request the Dutch population to do something, you're basically saying to do what you want, right? And we hope, it's like a very hopeful thing, but does it have more moral force in...
I mean, it says, basically it's asking, requesting. So, so there is no immediate penalty or consequence for non-compliance.
Mm-hmm.
So basically government request and hoping that people would comply. So so in that sense it's quite limited. I mean the governors of those emergency area can do certain things with stronger measures, such as like using land and building to construct and like operate like a temporary medical facilities without consent from property owners. But those are probably like one or two of the extreme things that they can do, and everything else is like requesting, asking for cooperation.
No, I was going to ask you what your impression of the cooperation has been like, or compliance, and does the government sort of report on that? Or, you know, because in the Netherlands, like Darshan was saying, you know, they make these announcements where they say, please do this. And then the next week, they announced the ability for local governments to fine people if they weren't complying.
Mm.
And so you said that's not possible in Japan, but does the government kind of report, thankfully these businesses are voluntarily closing? Or is there not much
I do see some reports saying that, like this percentage of restaurants in downtown area decided to shorten the operation or do something. And some prefectures do offer like a one-time or two-time payments for those businesses who decided to cooperate. I mean, the amount is, I don't think it's big, like maybe equivalent to like $5,000 or $10,000. So probably like not big enough for like not operating for like 2 weeks or 3 weeks. But yeah, so.
Yeah, okay. So they're giving them a reward. They're not threatening them with a punishment.
Right. So it's more like a reward. Of course, there might be some, informal punishment by the public, perhaps, in case of non-compliance. But that's that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe those like places.
What do you mean by that?
Like a publicity in a negative way. It might be possible that. you know, they get some negative comments and evaluations by the public, and yeah, but maybe that's nothing. So yeah, basically just hoping that they would cooperate, yeah, and giving some rewards for that. Of course, how much reward government should is a big source of controversy now. So some people think what the government is doing not enough.
Yeah.
And there has been a discussion about giving away approximately like $1,000 to everybody in the country, hoping that it might help the situation in various ways. For example, like helping the employees of businesses who had to stop their operation, like pay for rent and, you know, utility, and so on. Anyway.
Yeah, that makes sense. It sounds similar, yeah, to the debate in the U.S. About what the best mechanism is.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but whereas, I mean, the U.S., I think, like, and in many other countries, you've seen quite a separation between, like, the economic side, right? We're going to deal with the economy and, you know, keeping things running and pumping money into the economy. And then there's all of these sort of control measures. Yeah, like in your opinion, is there like a greater bind between those two things in Japan, like a sort of a give and take between the state and society on you comply and we
related,
we help you out here.
Closely related, and some people do focus on the health issues, so their primary concern is health, but others think that you know, measures for policies aimed at preventing the spreading of virus may not work unless we incorporate like economic compensation. So in that sense, I think these two things are related with each other, and many people do talk about it. Do talk about the link between the two. So I guess there are people who mostly focus on health issues, and there are those people who are really concerned about economic hardship that we are going to see from now on. I mean, some people do claim that perhaps more people might suffer from economic difficulties than the coronavirus itself. So, and there are people who, yeah,
right.
Sorry.
Right.
So, Kia, oh.
Oh, no, no.
No,
and
no,
there, there are
ahead.
Those
Sorry,
people
I
who think that these two things are related with each other. So without generous economic compensation, effective health,
yeah,
measures are not possible. So we should provide generous compensation in order to make,
uh-huh,
sure that the health policy works.
So one of the things that I think has been really interesting from afar as well in terms of Japanese decision making has been that they closed the schools,
yeah,
much earlier than the sort of emergency,
right,
measures. And here, the discussion about the schools is often connected to the economy also,
mm,
right? Because if everybody's home from schools,
mm,
and daycares, then their parents can't continue working as effectively from home. And so some justification for reopening the schools has been around also, you know, promoting more economic activity. And in Japan, I just wonder how, I mean, my impression based on only superficial knowledge of Japan was that Japan is in a position to close the schools without having this huge economic trade-off because so many mothers don't go back to work full-time in Japan. So it's not really changing workforce participation as dramatically as it would in an economy where both parents work full-time jobs.
Yes. Yeah, so the implication is that the impact of school closure is probably unevenly distributed across space, and the impact varies across people. So I guess in urban areas, there are probably many people, in areas where many mothers have to work and where there are no relative to take care of their kids. In those places, I think, people are very, very concerned about school being closed for such a long time. I mean, they cannot work, they have to take care of kids, so they cannot work, and huge implication for their household's economic well-being. But if they continue to work, can they take care of kids? So, yeah, so there has been concern, although I'm not sure whether and to what extent the full time, whose mothers have not gone back to full time work, had similar concerns. So probably depends. I think your point makes sense. So I guess when Prime Minister announced that schools should, so again, this is actually not a strict order again. So that was end of February, February 27th, I think. So Prime Minister announced that he would like to request that schools be closed. So actually he didn't. So it wasn't like he made an announcement then all the schools closed, but he said, I would like to request that those who are in charge of taking care of schools middle and elementary public schools that should be municipalities, the lower layer of local government. So he was asking them to strongly consider the closure of schools until the end of spring break. So that was it.
And were there any municipalities that are sort of like, nah, yeah,
there are a small number of municipalities. I remember a very interesting case. There was a municipality whose mayor refused to comply. Then soon after, there's a positive case of corona in that city. So he had to just follow the decision, follow the request and close the school. And now some schools are actually being open from April. For example, in Niigata Prefecture, I saw kids going to school from the beginning of April. However, the local government decided to close the school from, I think, April 25, from tomorrow to at least the end of the first week of May. It may continue, actually. That's the situation. So we still don't have kids, so I haven't experienced that in my personal life. But
you're lucky.
Yeah, we
well, no, I shouldn't say that. Children are a blessing. Children are a blessing. Children 24 hours a day are a lot. A big blessing.
Still a blessing, but
too much of a good thing.
I want to get it more into this, like the way in which the laws have been introduced, and whether, like, from an outsider's perspective, this notion of a request and the way in which it's been pursued seems very softly. And are there specific local, either cultural or constitutional dimensions that limit?
Thank you very much for
taking those back.
So this emergency declaration is actually based on the amendment to the act to deal with new type of influenza. So there is a law enacted to deal with influenza. A new type of flu. I think you call it like swine flu and something like that. However, this law didn't have specific mention to like a coronavirus, of course. The parliament passed the amendment to this law in, I think that was second week of March. And the emergency declaration is, the Prime Minister's emergency declaration is based on this particular act. So it's not like it's not like Constitution has a special clause for like an emergency declaration and...
You were saying that there's a sort of sense that the state should be more restrained in a post-war Japan, and I wondered if that's come out of, you know, people pushing back in some cases when the state seems to be overreaching, and if there's a sort of iterative kind of push and pull about keeping the state sort of restrained, or if really it's sort of non-controversial or something, if that, like, as if that's just a settled outcome of this what you said was a traumatic experience.
Yeah, it's actually a very difficult question, I think. But okay, so like before election, like newspapers and like media conduct opinion polls and asking people what issue they consider is important. And I mean, in many cases, people mention current economic condition and like social security. So, and those are the two major issues. And not so many people mention, like, you know, these constitutions or dealing with emergency situation and so forth.
Yeah.
So I guess from the perspective of like general public, they probably didn't see that urgent and important issue. And I mean, LDP, the ruling party, so they do claim that the constitution should be amended, so it's never been amended, but I'm not quite sure whether and to what extent LDP members desperately want to do it. I mean, even when they have overwhelming majority in both houses combined with coalition partners, it hasn't happened yet. So and of course
maybe this No, I was going to say, I wonder if, you know, now seeing how other countries are facing the pandemic with a lot more state authority, if there will be more calls in Japan on the flip side of my question, which would be more saying, yeah, actually, we should give the state more authority to make a sort of, you know, to have the power to shut down certain businesses and this kind of thing.
Okay, so again, this is my impression. So small number of people do make such remarks, but I think majority of people do appreciate the fact that they have greater degree of freedom. So I think it's going to depend to some degree on what's going to happen in terms of the outcome. So if the, you know, if Japan has been able to keep the death number low and, you know, remains relatively successful, then I think people will really appreciate the fact that so it wasn't the measures that the government took were not as strict as like more successful countries, perhaps like in the neighboring Asian countries. But if the society is able to manage to deal with this issue without restricting like severely people's rights and freedoms and property rights, I think that's something that many people are going to feel proud about. Yeah, so that's what I guess. But I think much of the thing, but I think it's going to really depend on how it's going to the outcome,
what happens.
Because
so
just judging from the number of deaths and so forth, I think that Japan is relatively doing well, but I think it's really important to be cautious and humble, because the situation could change dramatically in a short period of time. It's been working now, but there's no guarantee that it's going to continue to work well. I guess much of the debates about how people are going to perceive in terms of how much state can do in case of emergency and crisis probably depends on what's going to happen from now on.
So I was also, I mean, speaking of like these actors, right? So before you were saying, giving examples of the kinds of places the government requested to shut down, and it seems like, you know, pachinko places might be on the list, and restaurants and bars and businesses that we know our friends in the Yakuza are highly involved in. And I wonder how this dynamic of like requesting establishments to close when you know, there's a kind of like, organized crime behind them. Like, how much does the government expect Yakuza to comply with these requests, or do you hear anything about like how Yakuza is responding? Or I'm just really curious about that.
And before you respond, so I think like our listeners will understand Yakuza, but Kyohei, you have to explain pachinko first, and then you can let us know the answer.
I guess so. So there's Yakuza.
Yeah, there's Yakuza.
And Yakuza has certain connections with certain business,
right?
I guess the link between pachinko is kind of questionable.
Okay.
I think like the general entertainment industry, like bars in Kabukicho and those areas, and then the relationship between those places and Yakuza, that's what people talk about a lot. In terms of pachinko, I'm a little bit skeptical. I actually don't know. But at the same time, so pachinko is one thing. So pachinko is, of course, a gambling place that you see everywhere in Japan.
Wait. It's not just a gambling place. It is like an ice box with an enormous amount of noise coming at you and bright flashing lights where people sit all day and gamble their money away.
Yeah, so
they're extremely cold and
great
extremely loud.
Place, when we think... Yeah, so when we think about preventing the spreading of virus, that's probably not the right place to
to
go,
be.
Right? So,
no.
After the emergency declaration, I think prefectures have started talking about strongly asking pachinko place to suspend their operation for a while. And I'm not actually following up on the latest update, but so several days ago there was a debate about how the government can induce compliance, and one of the things that was being discussed was how about publicizing the list of pachinko places who did not comply. But of course, counter argument was that for those people who really want to go there, it's a great list, right? So they got to get the list and travel all the way. So, but I think now, perhaps maybe like today or yesterday, there are some update about this pachinko place, and I think some places are in fact complying. So. So it's quite I think that's quite interesting. Yeah, I think that's quite interesting, and I think many people do enjoy that. So I guess.
Well, Kyohei, I think
from politicians,
since you study local politics in Japan, I think this is something that you need to start gathering data on, like the timing of the compliance, not just by pachinko parlors, but also other establishments, to see like in different prefectures. Are they extra compliant?
Yeah.
And in other prefectures, are they really rebellious and keeping things open? I think that would be really
fascinating. That's a fascinating question. I would actually love to know. It's actually a fascinating question. I think I should probably start collecting.
Yes, do it.
Yeah. I really want to do that.
Monday morning meetings on migration is brought to you by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can find us on our WordPress site or alternatively on Facebook or Twitter. If you have ideas about a show that we ought to feature or a guest that we ought to have on, please contact Abby or I on imes@uva.nl.